it's funny that psychiatry never really defined what mental health is. And so in that whole deficit model, you know, it's like the definition of mental health is the absence of symptoms. Like, would you say if you're asymptomatic, like that you're well? Is that a definition of wellness or health? If I'm on a path to grow and develop and, you know, be an organism on the surface of the earth, which means experiencing a lot of adversity and challenge and growing from that, hopefully adapting to new situations, that's going to come with a lot of uncomfortable, quote unquote, symptoms.
Hello, friends. Welcome back to the Evolving Earth podcast, where we speak to creators, entrepreneurs, and visionaries who are creating the world we want to live in. I'm your host, Will Sachs. Welcome back. Let's begin. Hello, friends. Welcome back to another episode of The Cast. Today on the show, I have an amazing guest for you, a groundbreaking physician who is rewriting our understanding of mental health and well-being, Dr. Will Vanderveer, MD. Dr. Will is founder of the Integrative Psychiatry Centers, where he and his team use the most innovative treatments, including ketamine, to get down to and address the root causes of mental illness. They believe that mental health should consider the whole person. It's really beautiful, the model they put together. Dr. Will also runs the Integrative Psychiatry Institute, whose goal is to create and sustain a revolution in mental health to combat our mental health crisis. The Institute is currently training hundreds of psychiatrists in integrative psychiatry, which is a new, more holistic model of mental health and well-being. And because of what I just said, Will is a leader in the adoption of integrative psychiatry practices globally. He's published research on MDMA-assisted psychotherapy for PTSD and written book chapters on the fields of ketamine-assisted psychotherapy and other clinical applications of psychedelic compounds. Will is one of our nation's most respected ketamine physicians, and in addition to traditional medical training, he is also a meditation instructor and is trained in shamanism, EMDR, somatic experiencing, internal family systems, cognitive behavioral therapy, and hypnosis. And in this conversation, we trace his journey through traditional psychiatry training to becoming disillusioned with conventional pharmacological interventions, through his discovery of psychedelics, MDMA, and ketamine as treatment modalities for trauma and depression. And we discuss the results he's seeing with his patients, which are truly stunning, and his current efforts to redefine mental health and psychiatry training in the US and indeed around the world. I'm learning so much in each of these episodes in this series on psychedelic healing. This episode is no exception. So please enjoy my conversation with Dr. Will Vanderveer. This episode is brought to you by The Trip Report. The Trip Report is a totally badass online newsletter and blog written by my friend Zach Hagney. Every week, Zach scours the globe for the latest and most exciting psychedelic news and happenings, and then he packages them up for easy consumption in beautifully written and clearly articulated articles that paint a fascinating picture of where our culture is headed vis-a-vis psychedelics. He addresses the pitfalls, the opportunities. He looks at the news from a business perspective, a policy perspective, an impact perspective. It's really an incredible resource. In his words, I pick out the psychedelic news and ideas that you don't want to miss in all the noise and give them context and analysis. So for anybody interested in learning more about the current psychedelic renaissance, head over to thetripreport.substack.com or just Google The Trip Report and you'll find it there. It'll be the first one. It's really awesome content and I hope you guys check it out. Again, that's thetripreport.substack.com or just Google The Trip Report. This episode of the podcast is brought to you by Fulcrum Venture Accelerator, the fundraising accelerator for mission-driven entrepreneurs. If you know me, you know that I love entrepreneurship, and I believe it's one of the most powerful forces we have to help create a future that works for everybody. Our mission at Fulcrum Venture Accelerator is to harness this very power and help human potential flourish. Every 3 months, we scour the globe for the most impressive entrepreneurs building impactful companies, and we take them through a 3-month accelerator program focused 100% around helping them close seed financing. Our process has already been used to close more than $20 million for companies in verticals like healthcare, climate, wellness, and education, and we're just getting started. So if you or someone you know is creating something impactful and is raising seed capital, please go to fulcrumventureaccelerator.com to download free resources and get free pitch feedback. Again, that link is Fulcrum Venture Accelerator, F-U-L-C-R-U-M, ventureaccelerator.com. See you there. Dr. Will, welcome to Evolving Earth.
Great to be here, Will.
I thought a good place to start would be with your story, because I found it compelling as I heard it, and I'd love to hear about, you know, your training as a psychiatrist, and then what happened?
Yeah, so I took a pretty traditional path through medical school and psychiatry training and finished in 2002. So I've been out for almost 20 years. And right after graduating from psychiatry training, I started a practice, and I was pretty excited about doing psychotherapy and, you know, kind of medication management. And I got out there and pretty quickly realized that the psychotherapy and the medications were not enough to really empower people and really get people on their way. And so after I sat for my boards and got board certified in psychiatry in 2004, I ended up quitting psychiatry. And I thought I was done. I headed down to a small town in Colorado following a Buddhist teacher who I was learning from. And I thought, well, I'm just going to find something else to do. But slowly, as I was meditating for many hours a day during, it's kind of like a year-long meditation retreat in a way, in a small cabin in a tiny town, it dawned on me that I really felt the call to heal people and to be in that relationship with people. So from there, I realized that I had dug my own hole by not knowing what to do with people and how to help them genuinely heal. So from that point, I realized I needed to go get some better tools. And so that led to a whole journey of lots of additional training that I didn't get in my residency or medical school in almost, you know, any area I could find, whether it was the gut-brain connection was a big first one, balancing hormones for people with psychiatric challenges was another one. The role of inflammation became an issue. I went and got trained with Peter Levine in somatic experiencing. So I had a kind of what felt like a more potent PTSD tool in my kit.
And are any of these things touched on in normal, quote unquote, psychiatry training?
No, not really. I mean, normal psychiatry training in the late 90s when I was there was really about the DSM, you know, so labeling people with these conditions based on symptom recognition. So, you know, diagnosing something based on symptoms is not really looking for a root cause. Like, why is the person depressed? Why is the person have panic attacks? So you'd say, well, the person has a panic disorder, but you don't look for the reason why they're panicked. And it seems like an obvious question, right?
It does.
So, you know, I'm grateful for the training, and it was just incomplete in a lot of ways, basically. It's what it came down to.
So you got out in 2002 and you wrote the boards in 2004, and then you quit almost immediately, or you know, something clearly wasn't working. What was that experience, that period like for you? Like, what happened?
Well, so I had, you know, between the time I graduated and passing the boards, I had a couple of years of building up my practice. So I went from scratch to a full practice in about a year. And I thought that the medications and the psychotherapy were going to be enough to get people on the road to really feel empowered in their lives and feel on fire and excited about how they're living. But what I noticed was that I was able to get people where they were functional, but they weren't really thriving. So, you know, I've always felt like mental health was about thriving and feeling excited, not, you know, abnormally excited, like, oh, I'm always excited. I never have a bad day. Not like that, but like being in the question of what is my purpose? Why am I here? What is this life about? And, you know, digging into that question. And I felt like too many people were not getting there with the tools that I had available at the time. And so I just had people clogging up in my practice who were not thriving. And that was around the time that I started meditating and started teaching people how to meditate. And at that time, for me, that was a big step outside of the conventional. I mean, when you think about it in 2020, you know, mindfulness and meditation is kind of like, hello, it's pretty mainstream, right?
Especially in Boulder, right?
Yeah, like, exactly.
Yeah.
And I found that mindfulness practice really did help people tolerate extreme states better and feel more regulated, but it wasn't the whole answer for too many people. And I had one experience with a patient, which I've talked about on other shows. I don't know if you've heard it before, but the summary was that this is around 2006 when I was thinking about coming back to Boulder and opening my practice again. I ran into a former patient who had the generosity to share with me what happened after he left my practice when I quit. He went and saw a naturopath and was tested for celiac disease and was positive. He stopped eating wheat. And slowly but surely, over a few months, his symptoms of panic attacks and not being able to go out and do the things he wanted to do in his life, not being able to ask the girl out he wanted to ask out, all of those problems melted away. And then he tapered himself off the medications I had prescribed him. This is a person who I'd worked with for over a year in weekly therapy, cognitive therapy, meditation, different medications. And essentially what was happening was that he got off of the toxin that he was putting in his body every day, and his symptoms went away, and he went off his meds and had no further symptoms. And I checked in with him, I think it was a year and a half or so ago, just to see how he was doing, because I haven't seen him in, you know, 15 years. And he was like, yeah, doing great. You know, had a couple kids with that girl I finally asked out, and you know, got them both tested for celiac right away. One of them was positive, so he's not going to have the experience I had, and
wow,
so forth.
Yeah.
So it was really, really helpful to and humbling, you know, as a practitioner, to have somebody go out and get the answer and then come back and teach you what you didn't test them for, you know?
Right.
And it was really encouraging because I realized that for some people, the gut-brain connection was going to be a huge lever for getting them, you know, on the road.
Yeah, it makes me think of... I've done some business coaching over the last couple of years since I left my company. And with some people, I'm taking their money, but I'm not delivering the result. And then after that goes on for a little bit, it starts to become this personal crisis for me. Cause I'm like, I'm not helping this person. They're not getting the result they hired me for. And I'm continuing to take their money. And then I got, when I was down in Peru, that the definition of that is like one word would be parasite. Pretty extreme. I got that in ceremony and I'm like, okay, what do I do with that? And it seems like that's a dilemma for people in the healing professions and in our culturally accepted mental health profession, is if people aren't getting better, but they keep coming back, like talk therapy would be an example of people going to talk therapy for 10 years and not necessarily getting what they came for. Was it that kind of experience for you in psychiatry?
Yeah. Yeah. Thanks for drilling in there. That's exactly what was happening, was more of an existential crisis of, wait a second, if I'm a doctor and my people are not getting, if most of my people are not getting well within, you know, a year or two of working with them, what's going on? You know, what's wrong with the healing that I'm providing? And, you know, it's funny, in we're skipping ahead here for me to bring this up, but I was at a ketamine conference a couple years ago where someone was talking about the practice of giving people IV ketamine without psychotherapy. And they were saying, look, you know, people come back and they need more ketamine. And so what are you doing? Like, is this really better than Prozac? If the person is having to come back and is now dependent on the treatment, the speaker used the word annuity to talk about a patient who, similar to what you're talking about, right? Is the person is not progressing, they're not reaching their goals, and yet you continue to take payment for them. You know, what's going on there?
The annuity model of healing.
Right.
That's been the model, and people have spreadsheets and they've got shareholder updates, and there's billions of dollars organized around us as annuities.
Making sure people are not quite well.
Right. But think that they maybe are making progress or something. It's pretty chilling and dark.
It is dark. It's very dark. And you could, I mean, there's so many different industries that are tied in as well. I mean, you know, we could go down the rabbit hole, but there's, you know, the way that we grow. I mean, I've been listening a lot to Zach Bush recently, who is he went to the medical school I went to, and he has this amazing perspective on the role of healthy soil for healthy humans. And it just makes a lot of sense to me that, you know, we apply massive amounts of pesticide, and in particular glyphosate, which is Roundup. And then, you know, this disrupts the biome of the soil. And then, you know, inside of our digestion, it disrupts the microbiome in the human being, which disrupts the metabolism of amino acids that are essential for neurotransmitters, which can cause anxiety and depression, and not to mention autism. So there's just, and then, you know, we have all of the industries that sort of help, like suppressing the symptoms of those things, but not really.
I mean, it's fascinating that Monsanto sold to Bayer.
Right.
You know, the chemicals being sprayed on the soil and the chemicals being sprayed on our physical corporal soil. Yeah. Right. So that's been the model. And it seems like as a culture, do you feel like we're waking up?
Well, I think the crisis of COVID and seems to be partly a wake up for people. I think the Black Lives Matter situation with the murder of George Floyd and other people of color has, I think there's an incredible opportunity for us to all be waking up to how we've been doing things. I think that time will tell whether the stress levels are sort of too high for this to be a growth experience for us as a culture, or is it going to be more of a disintegration into more chaos? I hope it's the former, but I think the jury's out, especially with the election coming in the fall. And there's just a lot going on right now. And I think so many people are way over their head with the stress levels. And so, you know, whether this becomes a growth opportunity or not, I think depends on, in trauma therapy or even just psychology in general, we have this notion of the range of tolerability, which is sort of a growth range, where if you're understressed, you're not going to grow. If you're overstressed, it's hard to grow. So the way I'm approaching it right now, in terms of your question of, are we going to grow from this, is if I can beef up my self-regulation and interpersonal regulation strategies enough to widen the range of tolerability for me, then I think I can make use of the growth opportunity and turn it into something. But it's a very active process where I can't just rely on the usual levels of self-care, let's say. So I think that, to me right now, you know, from a Caucasian male, you know, privileged cisgendered person in this culture, is like, that's the growth opportunity for me, is to double down on self-care, interpersonal care, and really listen and try to be a part of the solution.
I'm finding the same thing, that just to regulate myself takes more energy every day and not always successful. And just to spell that out, because this was new to me, this range of, would you call it, window of tolerability? So it makes sense intuitively, but can you just explain how that applies in, you know, in trauma and psychedelic? It sounds like it applies in trauma and in therapy, psychedelic therapy in life.
Yeah, definitely. So in the concept of stress is an interesting one, where you have kind of maladaptive levels of stress, and then you have the concept of eustress, EU stress, which eustress is within this range of tolerability where you become more resilient from getting stressed. So they have these really horrifying rodent studies called the swim test for mice, where you throw a mice in a bucket of water and you let the mice swim around until they give up. So the experiment is to do things to the mouse before you throw it in the bucket of water to see if it tries harder for longer, if it swims for longer periods of time. And one of the things, one of the early pieces of information about that was that if you immobilize a mouse, or if you do other stress-inducing things to a mouse, and then you throw it in the bucket of water, it'll swim longer. And so this became like a kind of a litmus test of developing resilience from getting stressed. And we can all, I think a good human example of this is, you know, when I was in like first or second grade, and there were kids in my class who had older brothers at home who had tested them and maybe bullied them or brutalized them at home. they were the ones who ran the show on the schoolyard because they'd been tested at home.
Right.
So
think about like the couch potato getting up and trying to run a marathon versus somebody who runs every day.
Perfect example, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. So there is, I think, a growing perspective in the world of psychotherapy that stress is necessary. Stress is important. Stress makes us resilient. In the past, like when I was taught back in the day in the late 90s, stress was like, oh, stress is bad. You don't want to have stress. You want to have a low stress situation. But I think what's really important is this situation of the window of tolerability, where if you erase all stressors from, like take the couch potato, for example, right? They're not going to be all that resilient. They're not going to be able to handle COVID very well. They're not, you know, they're not going to be able to run that marathon. They can't even run down the block probably. So from that perspective, I think it's a really interesting new theme in medicine of doing the right kinds of stresses at the right times for the amount, right amount of time, the right level of severity of the stress in order to build that resilience.
Yeah. And so back to the story about psychiatry and the drugs. So like, could you see somebody who's over-medicated on psychiatric drugs as being relieved of the beneficial stress potentially?
Yeah. So I've written about this a lot because it's a really strong belief I have from having so many years of writing prescriptions for people that I was trained as a resident in psychiatry to keep cranking up the dose of a medication until the person had no symptoms at all. And then when I got out in practice and I started, you know, doing that with people, what I found out was that the desire to reimagine your life really drains away if you're not in pain. And, you know, we could go down a whole Eastern philosophy perspective here around the importance of suffering. But the maybe long story short is that I think at this stage in the game, as human beings, we still have to suffer in order to be motivated to do something different in our lives. So I started playing around in the early 2000s with deviating from what I was board certified to do and, you know, sort of like took an oath to do to medicate till the symptoms went away and to sort of take the view with medication that I could sort of lower the hurdle for people to get into a growth mindset by using lower doses of medications for shorter periods of time. And not taking the approach that you want to, you know, napalm all the symptoms in order for the person to be quote unquote cured of their condition. And I knew it wasn't a cure because psychiatric medication never cures the problem. It just suppresses the problem. So it would make sense to suppress. It'd be like having a broken leg and, you know, maybe you need to take ibuprofen or maybe even opiates for a few days to be functional enough to meet the challenges of your life. But that's where I find that psychiatric medication sometimes can be really useful if you use it in the right way. But eradicating symptoms completely almost always comes with some kind of side effect, like feeling like a zombie or, you know, pretty numb or out of it or just apathetic, you know, like I don't really care that much about the problems I have in my life anymore. It's fine.
Yeah.
That's not my goal for treatment. You know?
Yeah, it's like what just came into my head is you want your annuities to be apathetic.
Right. But the funny thing is, like, I've actually had to really work with a lot of people on this issue because it's a cultural issue. It's not only a pharmaceutical industry issue of I don't want to feel any pain. I don't want to feel any adversity. I don't want to have that difficult conversation with the bully at work or the boss who's objectifying me or dominating me. So this concept of embracing challenge and empowering ourselves and moving forward with our lives is not, it's not so much of a cultural theme, I think, for us.
Yeah, interesting. It's kind of like we want accomplishments, but we want them to come easy. It's weird because culturally we have a benefit to hard work, but the hard work's supposed to be fun as I feel into it. That's what it feels like to me.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. I think that, you know, there are problems with our educational system because we don't teach children this idea of like life is a journey of finding out who you are and then expressing yourself and facing the adversity that it necessarily does take for you to fully express yourself in the world. You know, that's not a part of the curriculum. again, it sort of goes to this industrial complex that you're talking about, where we're teaching people to be good factory workers, essentially, which is really unfortunate because it takes a lot of effort for people to undo that enculturation.
Yeah. So back to this, your story, because I want to keep tracking along the path here. So you said the mind-gut connection was kind of the first new tool. And then you went and sought out other tools. And I saw shamanism, EMDR, somatic experiencing, internal family systems, hypnosis, CBT. What was that exploration like? Was that a multi-year thing?
Yeah, I would say from basically like 2005 until about 2011 or 12. So it was a 7 or 8 year journey of doing every kind of training and every kind of sort of rabbit hole that I could find to go down. Some of it was functional medicine, some of it was psychotherapy, some of it was, like you said, shamanism, diving into spirituality, ways that that can heal people. Some of it was what we call like lifestyle medicine. So, you know, the applications of mindfulness and sleep hygiene and exercise as a prescription and learning about supplements and vitamins and, you know, botanical alternatives to medications. And so it was pretty broad. And I'm deeply grateful to my patients for, you know, being willing to be guinea pigs as I tried different things out. And some of it was great for some people and some of it was awful for some people.
So you came back to your clinic, the meditation, you came back, you're like, all right, I dug the hole, I got to fill it in, and then I'm going to go and expand my understanding.
Yeah. And for a while in the early years, it was like, okay, now I found the Holy Grail. This is going to work for everybody. And then it was like, oh, having that experience 5 times in a row, kind of disavowed that. It's like, okay, this is not a one size fits all situation. And so we developed this broad base curriculum now for practitioners to learn about all of these different areas, which has been fun. So yeah. So shamanism.
Yeah. Well, yeah. I was going to ask, how did you change during those 7 and 8 years?
Well, you know, I think the best way to answer that is I got a lot more humble about my place in the world and my role in the lives of the people that I have, you know, had the privilege to work with. And just not knowing the answers, I think, is it's an aversive thing for a physician to say, I don't know. You know, it's pretty scary and dangerous for a doctor to say that to someone. But, you know, it turns out to be one of the most powerful and healing things to say sometimes when it's true, right? It's like, I don't know how we're going to figure out how to solve this problem, but I'm in the conversation with you and I'm not going anywhere. And, you know, we're going to figure this out together. It feels a lot more honest to me than, oh, I'm the doctor, I've got the answers, you know?
It feels empowering to me as the patient. Because isn't that a big part of the shift that feels like it's happening, is that it used to be the doctor knew everything, the patient didn't know anything, and the doctor would give you the prescription, you follow it, and you're healed. And right. Now it seems to be shifting. We're realizing that that actually disempowers the patient.
Absolutely. It's been a slow transition, and you know, we've still got a lot of work to do to get to the other side of that, but it's definitely well underway. I mean, people are listening to podcasts, they're, you know, finding videos to watch on YouTube, they're empowering themselves, they're getting their questions answered. And it's really exciting. I mean, I find it a lot more fun to collaborate in a more eye-to-eye kind of way than, you know, to sort of perpetrate this sort of medical patriarchy kind of situation. But once again, it's interesting when when I sit down with people, some people don't like that. They want to be the person who comes in and, you know, has things done to them, and the doctor's the person doing things to them. And there isn't this kind of collaborative model of mutual responsibility for the outcome. So, you know, that's a case by case situation.
How do you deal with that? Do you have that conversation?
Yeah. I mean, sometimes we have to have that conversation. And usually at this point in my career, it's more of a earlier conversation from the beginning of how are we going to work together? You know, what are the kind of agreements that we have about working together? as opposed to just falling into that kind of trance of, you know, the doctor and the patient and the white coat syndrome and all that kind of disempowerment stuff.
And then, so how did ketamine enter the picture?
So that's hard to talk about without talking about MDMA, because I didn't know about ketamine until I was deep in the MDMA clinical research with MAPS.
And how did that come about? Was that from the shamanism?
Yes.
Nailed it.
Shamanism to MDMA to ketamine. So I was sort of a, you know, I was minding my own business, doing this process of learning all these different tools. And all of a sudden, I got a phone call from a friend of mine who has now passed on, but Jeremy Geffen was a buddy of mine in Boulder who was a cancer doctor. And he also was pretty deep in the ayahuasca world and had a Colombian teacher who was very powerful. So I had met Jeremy through sitting in ceremony with him. And he reached out of the blue one day in something like 2009 or I guess it was maybe 10 or 11 and said, look, their MAPS is going to start a MDMA study and they need a physician to help them out. And would you be willing to think about it? And I'd been to South America a few times and, you know, sat in ceremony quite a bit with ayahuasca, and it had been really powerful and helpful in my life. And I was one of those people who really had a very negative perspective about chemicals that were made in a lab and it's all about the plants and our relationship with the plants. And then I looked at the study that Michael Midhoffer and Rick Doblin had published in 2011, an early study on MDMA for PTSD, MDMA psychotherapy for PTSD. And they reported 83% of the folks didn't have PTSD anymore at a 12-month follow-up. So I was really impressed with that, given the fact that on my clinic outcomes, I couldn't hold a candle to that. I mean, I would, you know, for chronic PTSD, I'd be lucky if I got, you know, a quarter of the people well, which is more kind of in keeping with traditional treatments for PTSD. So that really got my attention. But I was still been pretty well indoctrinated in medical school that MDMA causes holes in the brain and it's always bad and it's a drug of abuse. And I had no experience with it personally. And so Rick Doblin tells a funny story about how, you know, he basically had to come to Boulder to talk to me and explain that there were these other possibilities with MDMA psychotherapy. And I reluctantly joined the group and ended up having an incredible education about combining MDMA with psychotherapy, and the privilege of getting to do those sessions as an MDMA therapist was incredible. And I got to refer a handful of people who I had previously treated into our MDMA study for PTSD and watched them heal. And so the whole thing really shifted my perspective about MDMA and had me thinking, as we talk, you know, but get back to the point, which is ketamine. I knew that it was going to be a few more years before MDMA could be considered by FDA to come off Schedule One. So I was looking for another tool that I could use and stumbled on ketamine. And then about 3 years ago, started providing ketamine-assisted psychotherapy in our clinic here in Boulder, which has been amazing. It's really helpful.
Yeah, I definitely want to talk a lot about that. But just on the MDMA, so I'm assuming you have to go through your own experiences with MDMA to be trained in that. Did you have any powerful experiences that you might be able to share with our audience?
So what you're talking about, inside of MAPS, they have a training study. So it's an FDA-approved research protocol that is designed for training MDMA therapists. So giving people MDMA inside of the protocol, you know, the very same thing, same type of session that the people with PTSD will have in the clinical trials. And I think it's a really important aspect of training. I don't know if you've experienced MDMA, but
I was a raver in the 90s. And so it was like an every weekend thing for a while, a portion of my youth, and incredibly powerful and transformative, and opened me to love is how I would describe it.
Nice. Yeah. I mean, love is a great way to describe it. when I'm not going to derail us onto another story, but there's a story about that that I'd like to share with you that was fun.
Share it if you want. I mean,
well, so in my MDMA research study that I participated in Boulder as a MDMA therapist, sometimes, well, I was also the study physician. So I had my own experiences with the participants where I had a female co-therapist, our principal investigator, Marcella Odolora, or one of the other folks. But then there were other times when I would just come in and the protocol involved the study physician coming to give the doses of MDMA. And so, you know, it was a double blind placebo controlled trial. So we didn't know what we weren't supposed to know, you know, it, whether people got MDMA or not, but it was a fun experience for me to go back to give the supplemental dose an hour and a half after the first dose and, you know, walk in the room and see what was going on with the participant. And usually it was pretty obvious to me whether they had gotten the first dose of MDMA or not. But the one time that I was thinking of when you brought up the word love was a person who kind of sat up from the couch and looked at me with this big smile on their face and said, "The messenger of love. You're the messenger of love." And so
you're like, this probably isn't the placebo.
Looks like that person might have gotten the active option. Yeah.
I mean, it was such a beautiful medicine for me. I was probably 20, 21, pretty, felt kind of closed off, and then would go to these parties and would have these experiences of feeling so connected to everybody else that was there and so connected to the music, connected to life. And then it would wear off and I didn't have any kind of therapy around it. I didn't know that that was a thing. So knowing what I know now, I probably could have integrated those experiences better. But I remember them being transformative and beautiful for me.
Yeah, I wonder about that sometimes because when I say that, I mean, you know, MDMA in a different environment. I know so many people who, after I got involved in the MDMA research, started sharing with me their, you know, rave experience or their social MDMA experience and talking about how transformative it was for them and how helpful and how beautiful. And I also have worked with a number of patients who had a huge amount of MDMA experience, but hadn't shifted the traumatic imprints that they had, that they were still carrying. And I think it's such an interesting thing about psychedelics generally, not to say that MDMA technically is a psychedelic, but these compounds that people use in a psychotherapy session can have such a different impact in the psychotherapy context versus the non-psychotherapy context. It's very interesting. It's almost like they're different. For some people, they're like different compounds altogether.
Well, I've been doing psychedelics for 20 years, but I never closed my eyes until 2018, the end of the year.
Oh, wow. Wow.
I'd never closed my eyes I'd never just sat in a chair, put on some music, closed my eyes for, you know, 10 or 20 minutes. And I've spoken about my experiences on this podcast, but that was a watershed experience for me to shift my understanding of what was possible with these compounds. And now having been on this journey of doing these episodes and having my own experiences, yeah, it's been incredible what's possible and what's available in terms of exploring the inner landscape for me. Coming as somebody who's had quite a lot of experience in the rave scene and in my youth.
Yeah, I mean, it's really different. So you would be a good person to comment on that as far as like having such a large expansive experience prior to closing your eyes for the first time.
Yeah, like there was just all this inner material that was hidden in the shadows until I went in there. And then it started coming up. I wrote about one of my experiences, a long experience with a long acting psychedelic, being sat and doing a closed eye experience. And one of the episodes in this series, if anybody's interested, go back and you can listen to that experience. But, you know, I regressed to childhood. I went back to being a tiny baby, re-experiencing all kinds of feelings from when I was less than 2 years old and came out of that feeling intense, like a different person for a while. It was like an ayahuasca experience, except stronger. So I'm a huge proponent. That's what actually had me start this series is my own experiences going in.
Yeah, I mean, I think there are all these different formats for healing, right? And the thing that really drives me is what can we get to the most amount of people soonest and safest as well. I mean, I think that's another important component of how do we move the ball forward if it's not too late for for our culture, you know,
and the planet. I hope it's not too late. It wouldn't be a good story if it wasn't like victory snatched from the jaws of defeat, you know?
Right. Yeah, that's a good point. Yeah.
So, okay. So MDMA, and then I saw you publish a paper with Marcella and Rick and some other researchers on MDMA for PTSD. And then you're like, all right, this is going to take a few years, but ketamine is here.
Right.
And available. So what was it like tiptoeing into that? And what has kept you, you know, so in that for the last few years?
So it was interesting finding out there were a lot of people around the MAPS community who already knew about ketamine as a facilitator for psychotherapy. So it wasn't hard to connect with training and in that, and then beginning to implement that I just took what I had learned in the MDMA protocol and adapted it to a ketamine situation. But it found out, you know, I found out that there were people who'd been doing this since the late 1990s or even earlier. There were people in the 70s using ketamine for psychotherapy even. But the first, you know, the first papers that I know about are from the late 90s. And then we had this whole series of research papers published from 2006 on up to now on IV ketamine, which were done at National Institutes of Health. So it felt like a pretty smooth transition. It was a little different. The route of administration with ketamine is different from MDMA. It's not like a pill in an 8-hour session, but we use the eye shades and the music and, you know, really go for the deepest healing we can get. So,
and what's the protocol that you guys have settled on?
So there are a lot of different ways to do it. And there are people who there's sort of like the spectrum of what's most researched to maybe what's less researched. And less research doesn't necessarily mean that it's less effective, but I feel a little bit more confident having studies to back up what I'm doing. And just as a scientist, that's how I want to conduct myself. So we do mostly intravenous ketamine treatments, and we do 6 in a kind of concentrated schedule. So twice a week for 3 weeks is the typical routine. And that's a lot for people sometimes. And, you know, sometimes we have to slow it down. But we also have integration and preparation sessions outside of the ketamine sessions. So it's really kind of set up as an intervention to get people moving. So it feels like the ketamine kind of works like a tow truck to pull you out of a ditch. And then you have to, you know, figure out how to get home from there. And that's a very different feeling that I have about how MDMA therapy works for PTSD, for example. I think ketamine is more of a catalyst to get the ball rolling in the right direction. But I think the risk of relapse after ketamine is much higher than with MDMA therapy. So more things need to be implemented.
Like it's more of a jolt, and then the integration sounds like is more important, so you don't end up back in the ditch, versus MDMA like fills the ditch with like love or something. It raises you up out of the ditch gently. Is that how you characterize them?
You know, I think so. I like to think of it as what are the root causes, you know, and with PTSD, by definition, we're talking about experiences where you felt overwhelmed or overpowered or dominated or abused, or you dissociated and blacked out while something bad was happening to you. Depression has a much more varied, heterogeneous set of root causes. So that's why I think that the MDMA psychotherapy tool is so highly effective for PTSD, because of what we know about how it works on the amygdala, what we know about how much easier it is to remodel memories with, you know, memory reconsolidation shifts on MDMA with being able to do parts work and, you know, kind of almost shamanic therapy and somatic psychotherapy on MDMA. It's very specific. It's a specific intervention to change a physiologic state that's switched on, like the fight or flight response being switched on.
Right.
So it feels relatively narrow. Like you would never, I would never say, okay, well, this person has PTSD and it might be from the time they had a head-on car accident and they watched their spouse bleed to death in front of their eyes, or it might be from their gut. But with depression, I would say, well, this person had a lot of abandonment that happened in their life. Their gut microbiome is also really messed up. Their hormones are way out of whack. They've got malnutrition from eating a standard American diet. They've got glyphosate going on. They don't know how to meditate. They haven't slept in 5 years. There's all kinds of possible root causes for depression. So that's why I think the integration piece with ketamine is, it's more subtle. And it's, I think you, my position is that ketamine is, as this tow truck that gets you on the road, isn't going to actually get you home. Because again, we talked about the annuity thing. So I don't want to get into the habit of giving people more and more ketamine just to kind of keep inflating the tire that keeps deflating on their car because they're consuming a lot of Roundup in their diet, for example.
Yeah.
So yeah, so I think the integration component of ketamine is important to tackle from this broader base of what we know up to this point, which is probably not anything what we're going to know in 50 years about depression. But we know that inflammation is also often a role. We know that, you know, hidden trauma can be a role. We know that malnutrition can be a role. Leaky gut can be a role. There's so many things that can be a role. So anyway, long-winded answer to what integration after ketamine can be about.
And what kind of results have you seen from the ketamine work that have led you forward into this? And yeah, I'm curious just to hear a little bit about that.
Yeah, so it's really remarkable. I have a bunch of friends who provide ketamine in their clinics around the US, and it seems like the results that they get are also pretty similar to what we see, which is seen in the research. So we see about 80% of the people who get ketamine. So 4 out of 5 people who do this protocol for chronic depression will have a life-changing result. So a big result in terms of the drop in their symptoms of depression in 3 to 4 weeks. So it's quite shocking to see that, you know, and people I've worked with, it's kind of like deja vu about the MDMA study and referring people into that study who I had worked with for years who hadn't gotten well with the tools I had available. Same thing with ketamine, where I gave ketamine to a number of people who had been under my care for, you know, 10 years. And to have people come out of that experience and say, wow, I don't know what to do. I've never not been depressed. Like, it's really shocking, you know, like now I have to know how to figure out how to live because I don't, this is very unfamiliar for me, and it's beautiful. And it's a lot of work to create a new life to that's not built around and infused with depression.
Wow. So freedom, it sounds like, for a large percentage of people.
Yeah. Freedom. And then it's like, well, what choices do I make now? And what does this mean about my relationships? And am I even living in the right environment? Like, do I need to move? Like, et cetera. So it's cool. So 80%, and the IV ketamine studies out of NIH showed about 70% of people had a massive drop in their depression scores pretty quickly. But again, I would say because they were IV ketamine only with no psychotherapy and no integration and no further investigation into root causes of the depression, they had people relapsing at a really high rate in those research studies. So a big part of the ketamine conversation for practitioners is, how do you make it last? How do you get the most out of it?
And what do you think?
Well, I think combining it with psychotherapy is a first step, so that you're actually, you know, able to, as you said, with your experiences, with your eyes closed, you know, investigate the inner landscape. You know, where are the dark corners? Are there disempowerments or traumas or things that have accumulated and layered into your psychology that are eating your lunch every day while you're going about your life thinking that you're a relatively successful person in the world, right? you know, you've been able to have a partner and you've been able to have kids and you've been able to be a physician, let's say, but you're just like ravaged by unconscious traumatic memories that are dominating your perception of life every moment of every day, you know? So how do we cleanse the doors of perception?
Yeah, it's so important to, I think, to make that point is that because people think of depression maybe as something that affects a certain strata of society or something. But I think Gabor Mate talks about, you know, that you can be addicted to heroin or you can be addicted to money and power. And you could be rich and a billionaire and depressed. My experience has been the outside and the inside are kind of separate. Like, as long as I've been trying to find happiness on the outside, it's not working.
Yeah. The only caveat I would say to that is when I started learning about attachment theory and the importance of secure functioning in relationships, and I started reading Stan Tachin's work, and then eventually basically said, look, this is something I want to have in my life. I want to have a secure partnership. I didn't know at that time that this kind of happiness could also be a thing that can happen, you know, with another person on that level of depth of security and functioning. So I don't know if I would categorize that as internal or external.
Yeah, me neither. Thank you for that. I'm just starting to experience that with Katie. Is this like shared joy of being in partnership.
Beautiful.
So, okay. So then the broader picture, you know, you've now founded the Integrative Psychiatry Centers and the Integrative Psychiatry Institute. And I presume that's to touch as many people as quickly as we can, like you mentioned. What are your goals with those two initiatives? And then how do you see that fitting into the bigger picture of psychedelics and mental health for our culture?
Yeah, thanks for asking. So a couple of years ago, my wife, Krista, and I we weren't married yet. We were just married last year, but this is about a year before we got married. We were at a seminar, like a personal growth seminar. And the teacher, the leader said, I want you guys to come back tomorrow morning with, you know, what would be the best thing you could do with the rest of your life. So we were sitting there that morning, the next morning, and having coffee in the hotel. And I just started crying because I had this kind of lightning bolt of inspiration that came in. I've been teaching integrative mental health care for a few years now and doing like little weekend, one day or two or three day seminars for a few years. And I realized that the problem with mental health care is really global, and it's been growing rapidly over the last, you know, well, for a long time. I mean, we're not seeing the changes that are happening in numbers of people with depression and trauma are escalating. They're not going down. And, you know, in other fields of medicine, like, we are doing a pretty good job, at least in, you know, highly industrialized places, of dealing with heart attacks, let's say, for example. So we're not doing a good job of getting after the mental health thing, and it's becoming a global crisis. So what happened was, Krista and I were sitting there, and I realized, you know, this isn't enough. Like, I need to take a bigger stand and really go after the bigger global problem. So it made sense to me to start out with training practitioners to have a bigger lens and to be able to condense this, you know, 8 or 9 or 10 year journey of going around and taking all these weekend seminars to develop your tool set and put it into 1 year so that we could take people through a journey of from beginner to competent in at least these broader areas, and learn how to recognize things like, you know, chronic infections causing depression or mycotoxin exposure or problems with detoxification pathways, or, you know, there's so many different things to be aware of. So my business partner, Keith, and I started this institute, and our goal is to train 10,000 people in the next 10 years. So by 2030, we want to have 10,000 practitioners who have the tools to meet the need. And so far, we just finished our first year, and we have 120 people who are coming through and graduating, and we have about 150 people signed up for next year. And these are physicians for the most part and some nurse practitioners. So, and it's fun because we have people from India and Australia and Canada.
Cool.
It's starting to become kind of a global movement, which is really exciting. And then on the side of the clinic, we're trying to really meet the needs of our local community here in Boulder with giving people the option to go deep into, well, let's look at the root causes of your struggle and let's see if we can resolve that and do the testing that you need for that or get the right therapy for that. Ketamine could be a part of that, maybe not. And after we have kind of done what we needed to do in Boulder, then we want to create other centers in other parts of the country so that, you know, more people have access to this kind of mental health care because it's still pretty new. There are practitioners around who are doing it their own way. But what I found over the years is that when I went to these different trainings, you know, usually they're taught by somebody who's really deep, but not very broad in their understanding.
Right.
So they can give you everything you need to know about hormones, but they don't even know that the gut has anything to do with mental health, for example, or vice versa. So because, you know, this phenomenon, I don't know if it's a Hindu or a Buddhist story of the elephant where everybody's touching a different part and everybody thinks it's something else.
With their eyes closed. Yeah,
exactly. Yeah. It's kind of a phenomenon in medicine and especially integrative medicine where, you know, somebody's going to say, well, I think this is, you know, we're going to give you a whole bunch of supplements for this. And then the next person's like, no, you need to change your diet for this. And it's like, no, you need to do your exercise for this. Or no, you need to do a detoxification thing. Or you need to do intermittent fasting. Or you can get very overwhelmed with all these different opinions from different people who are really good at that particular area, but they're not holding the bigger perspective.
Yeah, beautiful. And so are these mostly psychiatry people who've been through a traditional psychiatry training?
Yeah.
So you're kind of rewriting the script of psychiatry and health for psychiatrists to say, hey, there's a new model that considers the whole person, that considers the soul, that considers the body.
Right.
Come learn about it.
Yeah. And it's also not anti-medication, you know, like I was saying earlier, it's inclusive of using medications in a way to support this mission of mental health, as opposed to just trying to suppress things for people. It's funny that psychiatry never really defined what mental health is. You know, how do you know where you're going if you don't know what the goal is?
Right. There's like this huge book of what's not it, but there's right. No, what is
exactly.
It?
Exactly. Yeah. Exactly. And so in that whole deficit model, you know, it's like the definition of mental health is the absence of symptoms. Like, would you say if you're asymptomatic, like that you're well? Is that a definition of wellness or health? I mean, I wouldn't say that about myself. I mean, no, I have, wouldn't. If I'm on a path to grow and develop and, you know, be an organism on the surface of the earth, which means experiencing a lot of adversity and challenge and growing from that, hopefully adapting to new situations, that's going to come with a lot of uncomfortable, quote unquote, symptoms, right?
Right. Listen to the symptoms, right? That's what right. comes to my mind is exactly. what are they telling me about how I need and where I need to grow?
What's the wisdom?
Yeah, beautiful. So that's integrativepsychiatry.com, I believe.
Or, yeah, integrativepsychiatry.com for the institute. Yeah.
And the center is?
Is psychiatrycentersplural.com.
Beautiful. And so how do you see psychedelics fitting into the bigger picture of mental health? You mentioned when we were talking before, you said the words leadership, maturity, and restraint. And I thought those would be cool just to pick off one by one.
Well, okay, one by one. So leadership, I think that there's so many people who were so excited about this psychedelic medicine revolution that is kind of beginning to build momentum and kind of crest in the conversation about the future of medicine. And it is exciting. And there are incredible results being reported in these early psilocybin trials for depression, for example, and you know, the results that we got in our MDMA trials. Even the interim data analysis that Rick Doblin has recently been speaking about from phase 3 is really encouraging. So there's a lot of reasons to be really excited. And there's also a history here with psychedelics that's important to remember, which is that, you know, when people start, and I'm just going to, I think Timothy Leary gets picked on a little too much, but I'm just going to, you know, with gratitude for whatever he contributed to the movement, and I'm just going to use him as an example of the perspective that, you know, that people should be, everyone should take a psychedelic, or that every problem that a person encounters in their mental health can be fixed with a psychedelic, I think is a dangerous perspective. And I think that the set and setting is really important as well. So in terms of leadership, I think it's important for us to be sober about what we can treat with psychedelics and take a step-by-step approach. If psychedelics or MDMA are legalized, and you know, I hope for the benefit of humanity they will be, then we may have opportunities to look at, so to speak, off-label uses. So, you know, it's a common phenomenon in psychiatry to use medications for off-label reasons. So, for instance, we might use, you know, lithium for someone who is not bipolar for a particular reason. So hopefully we'll be able to go through that process and look into where could we apply these tools outside of what they've been approved for. But I think there's a problem with people racing ahead into, okay, well, you know, one case report or one proof of concept study is enough for me to start, you know, giving everybody this, or I'm going to go ahead and start doing this now, even though we don't have FDA approval, or, you know, so I just think it's a time to be sober and restrained.
Mature.
Immature, yeah.
There's this fear that I have of another Timothy Leary. And I think somebody asked Stan Grof, you know, what advice would you give for everyone who's pushing forward the current psychedelic renaissance? And I think his advice was, don't screw it up.
Yeah, right, exactly.
And so if anybody's listening and feels like they want to race ahead, I think it's important that we study history and see what happened last time, that all of this was on the cusp.
Yeah. I mean, there's too many lives at stake to screw this up. You know, we're talking about hundreds of millions of lives, if not more than that.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, even just depression is 100 million people who are not responding to treatment in the world. I mean, it's kind of hard to wrap my mind around numbers that big. Wow. But it would be a big tragedy and setback if things got derailed from this overexuberant perspective.
The other thing I wanted to touch on before we finish is the business side and how to make psychedelic therapy feasible, because as it's currently constituted, it's expensive, right? Very
right.
Expensive. How do you think about that? And what do you think we need to do to get this to all the people who need it?
Well, so there's a number of possibilities. I mean, first of all, Rick Doblin was asked on the Goop podcast a few weeks ago, you know, what does it cost? And Gwyneth Paltrow said something like, she quoted something like $25,000 for MDMA PTSD protocol, which is just, when I heard that number, I was like, whoa, that's just like, who can afford that, right? I mean, I wasn't thinking it was going to cost anywhere near that for MDMA therapy for PTSD, but we've got a big nut to crack there as far as figuring out the business model. I think part of it is going to be whether the FDA dictates that the exact protocol is followed that's being studied, which would make sense from an approval standpoint. If it's what's been studied, then it's what would be considered for approval. Mm-hmm. What I mean by that is the MDMA protocol involves two therapists in the room for 8 hours. And it involves a massive number of hours of preparation and integration. So it's at least 40 hours per therapist of therapist time. So when you start adding that up, if you're paying therapists a reasonable therapy, you know, rate, you know, you're looking at over $10,000 at least just for the, so to
just
speak,
the time,
payroll or the time,
yeah.
Right?
Yeah. Uh-huh. Yeah. I had Rick on this podcast. He was our first in this episode in psychedelic healing. And he was talking about group therapy as being a potential there. It sounds like you see another opportunity to, like, if we could streamline the protocol, maybe
streamline the protocol. And there are definitely advantages of having two therapists in the room.
Yeah.
Not the least of which is that one person can go to the bathroom while the patient has someone else to be with. I mean, 8 hours is a long time.
Right? You got to eat. Yeah.
Yeah. Eat, take a break, go drink some water, stretch your legs. So there may be possibilities as well of having an experienced, a really experienced therapist working with someone who's an intern or a someone just out of grad school. So I think we're going to have to be creative to figure that out. And then, you know, there are other costs too, to the treatment, like, you know, administrative costs, the rent for the space, how much work is it to maintain good communication with DEA and FDA. And there's probably going to be reporting standards for, you know, keeping databases up to date about how people are responding to the treatment. And we see that with intranasal ketamine, there's a reporting requirement. We have to fill in how people are doing and stuff. So it's a big task to figure that out. You know, we're trying to sort out how to make a clinic stay afloat with our ketamine program. And we're hoping that doing some of that groundwork will translate into hopefully getting to offer MDMA therapy later on.
Yeah. So, what does the ketamine protocol cost, and what are you learning in terms of keeping a clinic afloat?
So our ketamine sessions, there's two different prices based on whether most people, we really want to have ketamine psychotherapy. But sometimes there are people who can't afford the time of the therapist. So on a case-by-case basis, we might offer someone ketamine who's doing their own therapy work with an outside therapist, let's say, for example. Right. So we charge about $400 for a little under $400 for the ketamine session without the therapist. And it's a little more with the time of the therapist. So it adds up. And this is stuff that, oh, that brings me back to the other thing about trying to work out the business side of MDMA therapy is hopefully with the right data and the right approach to insurance companies, if it's FDA approved for the treatment of PTSD,
right,
it will then be easy to show third-party payers that this is actually a good investment.
An incredible money saver for the insurance companies. Yeah,
exactly. Exactly.
The opposite for the pharmaceutical companies, but
yeah. Yeah. Rick was saying something like, I can't remember the number he used for how much disability it costs for the VA to maintain a veteran with PTSD who has rip-roaring PTSD. It's really incredible. I mean, it's
right. It's like millions, right? Over the lifetime of somebody.
Exactly. So, you know, the cost of the treatment would pale in comparison to that. And obviously, you know, the person's quality of life is really what it's about. But I mean, from a cost comparison analysis, it should be pretty appealing on that level.
So is that the key then to get it covered by insurance and then make that case that, hey, you're going to save millions and millions over the course of the next decades? Is that the key to getting this to all the people who need it? Like those 100 million people that are depressed and billing their insurance companies for SSRIs?
I think this isn't really my area of expertise, but what would make the most sense to me is to just simply lay out the numbers and say, okay, here's a treatment that costs X and here's what the disease costs, which is X times 1,000 over the course of a lifetime, or X times 100 over the course of a decade, you know, and which do you want to pay? Do you want to pay 100X or do you want to pay X? You know,
right.
You guys decide if this is a good business move for your insurance company or not. I think that's the language that they speak more than anything else.
Yeah. And it seems like there's an opportunity for some of these new insurance companies like Oscar and these more innovative insurance companies to come in and beat their old stodgier competition by covering some of this stuff.
Well, and I think that's part of the play as well early on, is to have conversations with more progressive companies that have large amounts of employees that they want to offer innovative options for their healthcare. So that's another avenue in terms of mainstreaming something and proving the cost savings. So then you could go to Blue Cross Blue Shield or United Behavioral Health or Kaiser or something and make a big difference.
Yeah. So is anybody doing that? I picture these innovative San Francisco tech companies on their careers page saying ketamine assisted psychotherapy covered.
Yeah. There are people working on that.
That's so cool. I love that.
I would be psyched to work in a company like that.
Me too.
That option. Yeah.
Just to have that consciousness be in the leadership.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, what else on the business side of how to make this feasible? Is there Other thoughts you've got?
You know, I mean, another big piece is making sure, I mean, this is something that is a painful reality, is that, you know, there are communities of color that really need big time help with trauma and with all kinds of stress related conditions, depression, you know, all of the diseases of stress that come from that, diabetes, hypertension, you know, all these things. So how to bring tools like this to communities that, you know, where sometimes income levels are much lower than white communities in this country too, is a whole nother really important aspect. So does that come through nonprofits? Does that come through fundraising and grants? I mean, that's going to be a really important question. So it's not just, you know, another privileged opportunity.
Yeah, it sounds like if we were in Canada where I grew up, I'd say the government should do a giant outreach or just cover this for everybody, you know, under certain conditions as a way to invest in the social fabric. Maybe that's a potential here. I guess anything's possible. And if it's not the government, maybe it's like private foundations, like you said, just getting the capital together to be able to subsidize it and offer it.
Yeah. I mean, I think it's probably going to be trying to beat all the drums at once to get the most impact as fast as possible.
How fast do we have to do this? What do we got? What do you think?
Well, you know, I don't know how long we have. I mean, I guess I try not to discourage myself by getting into these bigger, overwhelming possibilities. And there was something the Dalai Lama said in response to a question about how do you deal with alcoholism? And he said, I don't know. You try to be with the person in front of you. I mean, so, or, you know, how do you fix global problems? Well, try to be nice to the person next to you, you know? And so I try to think globally, but act locally, you know, and do what I can within the realm of my impact or influence, and keep learning and growing and seeing my blind spots and trying to expand what I can do. But it's going to take a lot of folks, and there's a lot of people working on the solutions, but it's kind of a scary time right now, to be honest.
I keep thinking about the all that is necessary for evil to prevail is for good men and women to do nothing.
Right, exactly.
Sit idly by. Like there's a, it feels like the impetus to act is blaring in my face.
Yeah. Well, I mean, running your podcast is a way of acting, right? It's a way of getting the word out about opening minds and showing people possibilities that they maybe haven't thought about.
Exactly. My own small little way here. So we're kind of running out of time here, but I wanted to give you an opportunity to address anything that we haven't addressed thus far. Is there anything that sticks out or any final words, final topics?
I guess what I've been jamming about lately is, you know, what is health? You know, what's vibrant mental health? And if it's more than just not having symptoms, you know, what does it mean? And I think I'm curious what you have to say about that. How would you define that?
Well-being. I read a definition. Katie and I are reading this book called The Intimate Couple right now, which is fantastic. And they defined well-being as a feeling of home inside your body that you can always return to. And when you return to it, it feels like coming home. And I had an experience of joy the other day, which was kind of a first for me, where I felt it in my body. And it felt, I was like, what am I feeling in my body? I actually ate an edible and did breath work, and then was feeling this sensation in my body that I think was joy. And so I think that's my answer to your question is this feeling in the body of feeling like joyful and at home and at peace. And this is new for me.
Beautiful.
Yeah.
I'm glad you're having that experience.
Yeah. Thanks. What's your answer?
I think there's a number of things that I've learned over the last few years that really changed how I thought about that. I mean, I mentioned one of them earlier of secure relationship. I think being able to, and I'm not trying to propose that, you know, mental health means you're in a partnership, a committed partnership or monogamy or any, there's all the different ways to be happy and healthy in this world. But I think one component of it is this ability to collaborate with other people. And this is something I'm learning a lot from my wife, Krista, about. It's kind of her wheelhouse is how do people work together and how do they collaborate and what are their agreements? And, you know, learning how to not be the smartest person in the group and learning how to build something bigger than what I could ever do by myself and relishing that and seeing the kind of diversity of gifts and talents that people bring to the collaboration. And I think for me, it's also embracing the challenges that we were talking about earlier of how to know that if you're going to grow, you're going to be challenged. And so that's been a big piece is turning my perspective around challenge into a more positive or forward-looking point of view, which I can't maintain, you know, consistently, but that's a big one for me. Being in the question about purpose and values and mission and being in, you know, kind of like what I hear a theme in your life of stripping off the layers of dissociation or the protective layers and getting down deeper into who am I now or and then who am I now and who am I now. So I think there's, for me, I had this whole, you know, Buddhist phase in my life where I thought that my own regulation inside of myself was kind of the pinnacle of achievement and would probably lead me to enlightenment in one lifetime if I could just figure that out. And turns out life's a little more complicated than that. But the opening up in my heart of like this kind of collaborative and more, Krista calls it the we space, how do we operate together, has been a big eye opener for me. So it's kind of a rambling answer to your question.
Yeah, I love that. And I love being reminded of that. And what I thought of is the way that I relate to anyone or anything is the way I relate to everything. And I've noticed that in my life is that including myself. So my answer was more like somatic and yours was more about like, how do we relate to life, to people, to everything? And I love that answer. That's a beautiful reminder.
Thanks. The inside is important too.
Yeah. I feel like they're both getting at the same thing.
Yeah.
Well, Will, thank you so much for spending the time and thank you so much also for all the work that you do and who you are in the world and the stand that you take for integrative healing and for the responsible use of psychedelics. And you're someone I consider a mentor, even though we haven't spent that much time together. So just thank you.
Thank you, Will. It's been a pleasure. It's a fun conversation. Take good care.
This episode is brought to you by The Trip Report. The Trip Report is a totally badass online newsletter and blog written by my friend Zach Hagney. Every week, Zach scours the globe for the latest and most exciting psychedelic news and happenings, and then he packages them up for easy consumption in beautifully written and clearly articulated articles that paint a fascinating picture of where our culture is headed vis-a-vis psychedelics. He addresses the pitfalls, the opportunities. He looks at the news from a business perspective, a policy perspective, an impact perspective. It's really an incredible resource. In his words, I pick out the psychedelic news and ideas that you don't want to miss in all the noise and give them context and analysis. So for anybody interested in learning more about the current psychedelic renaissance, head over to thetripreport.substack.com. Or just Google The Trip Report and you'll find it there. It'll be the first one. It's really awesome content and I hope you guys check it out. Again, that's thetripreport.substack.com or just Google The Trip Report. This episode of the podcast is brought to you by Fulcrum Venture Accelerator, the fundraising accelerator for mission-driven entrepreneurs. If you know me, you know that I love entrepreneurship and I believe it's one of the most powerful forces we have to help create a future that works for everybody. Our mission at Fulcrum Venture Accelerator is to harness this very power and help human potential flourish. Every 3 months, we scour the globe for the most impressive entrepreneurs building impactful companies, and we take them through a 3-month accelerator program focused 100% around helping them close seed financing. Our process has already been used to close more than $20 million for companies in verticals like healthcare, climate, wellness, and education. And we're just getting started. So if you or someone you know is creating something impactful and is raising seed capital, please go to fulcrumventureaccelerator.com, to download free resources and get free pitch feedback. Again, that link is Fulcrum Venture Accelerator, F-U-L-C-R-U-M, ventureaccelerator.com. See you there.